We're not living in a random world. So this morning, our section is going to be verses 15 through 28, and we'll kind of work through them as we go. Right, because Jesus is going to make reference now, right? Then shall the end come. When is going to be the end? What are the signs of the sign of thy coming? And Jesus says, here's the beginning of sorrows and all these things, and then the end shall come. And then, number one, he gives to them either it's a historical event or what I would call the trigger, right? Because he is now about to give them an event, and he is going to gear their conduct around the event. Verse number 15, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Whoso readeth, let him understand. The end will come after these things, and accordingly, right, or in consequence of that, when you see this singular event, this will be the trigger for what you are to do next. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Now, we'll eventually get to this. You may have a note, or if you're not using a King James Bible, it might be translated differently, right? When we talk about the abomination of desolation, are we talking about an event, or are we talking about a purpose? You most of the time find it explained this way, the abomination which causes desolation. So is it an event or is it a person? I would argue that Matthew 24:15 kind of lends itself to thinking of it as an individual. When you see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place. So it could be the person who is abominable who is causing this, or it could be an event. And when you read this, and then it is almost always in parentheses, and in fact, it's possible that if you have a red letter edition of the Bible, it's not even red lettered as an edition. Whoso readeth, let him understand. And I think that the reference there is that you should understand Daniel. Right? Understand what Daniel is talking about. Whoever is reading Daniel, let him understand what Daniel says. Now, I just want to stop here because this is one of those areas that to me is easily confusing, and I find myself easily confused. Right? There are many, many people, probably the majority of people, who believe that Matthew 24 is describing in detail the destruction of the temple in AD 70. But those people do not believe that in and of itself that is the only abomination of desolation. And so we'll kind of get to that, but I just want to make sure that we understand in our minds that there really are two dimensions to this. There is the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, and then there is the destruction of the temple in AD 70. And they are not, in anybody's mind, not ours, not other views, they are not synonymous in the sense of describing the same exact event. And we will eventually come to that. Okay. The universal agreement, well, I guess we'll just kind of dive into this. Much consensus is that what Daniel is predicting when he refers to the abomination of desolation is the destruction, or the desecration, not the destruction, the desecration of the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes the IV in about 167 BC. So he's a Roman, and he's offers this hog on the Jewish altar, and it becomes then the abomination that brings about desolation. And this is why I say we need to understand this, right? Because here's, we all take the same approach or we don't all, but most believers take the same approach to biblical prophecy. And that is that biblical prophecy is usually fulfilled in two ways. That there is a short-term fulfillment of the prediction, and then the final fulfillment of the prediction. And we see that a lot, right? We see that, for instance, Isaiah chapter 6, when Isaiah is told that the hearts of the people are blinded and their ears are closed. And then we read in the Gospels that it is fulfilled, right? That is, 750 years later, we're still dealing with that same prophecy. So here are kind of, and again, I'm just dealing with this very simplistically, not because I think you're simple people, but because, we're not trying to turn this into a college-level eschatology class, right? The options are a couple, right? The abomination of desolation is B.C., 167 B.C. That is its short-term fulfillment. Long-term fulfillment, destruction of the temple, A.D. 70. Or abomination of desolation, 167 B.C., I keep saying destruction, desecration of the temple under Antiochus, long-term fulfillment still to happen. That would be our view, right? Still to happen, that the abomination of desolation has yet to happen. But others argue Antiochus Epiphanes, 167 B.C., short-term fulfillment, long-term fulfillment, destruction of the temple, A.D. 70, the abomination that caused the desolation. Now, we'll come back to Daniel, right? Because whoso readeth, let the reader understand. Let him understand. So we'll go back to Daniel chapter 9. But for now, let's just continue on with what Jesus says, right? So, in my mind, this is the way I'm dealing with it, right? Verse number 15 is the trigger, the historical event that is kind of this anchor point, right? So it becomes critical in this sense, right? Because we always want to know when, right? So when you see this, when you see the abomination of desolation, and if we can nail down with absolute certainty, beyond any shadow of a doubt, when that is, then we know what to do. And let me just pause and stop right there. There is nothing for you to do. There is absolutely nothing for you to do because none of this is written to us and none of this is written about us. And that has absolutely nothing to do with the rapture and everything to do with the fact that we're not Israel. We're not Jews. But when the trigger happens, right, when the trigger is pulled, when the abomination of desolation happens, then secondly, there are instructions given from that trigger, and that's verses 16 through 20. So when the abomination of desolation occurs, then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. All right, so here are a set of instructions. All right, so we're just, here we are. We're sitting outside. We're listening to Jesus talk. The question has been asked because Jesus has made his judgmental pronunciation, right, that he is done with Israel, that he is done with Israel, that their house is left unto them desolate, and that they're not going to see him again until they say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. And the apostles are beside themselves. Are you really suggesting that these magnificent buildings are coming down? Yes, not a stone left unturned. Not a stone left. When? And how will we know? Well, all of these things are simply the beginning of sorrows. And again, we can debate back and forth, folks, whether they're triggered by the beginning of the tribulation or not. The fact is that we know no other world than that is defined by the first 14 verses of Matthew. We know only a world that is plagued with wars, rumors of wars, political unrest, natural disasters, religious peril, persecution. That's a world we know. Right? And don't be agitated. This is just the start. This is just the start. But, when you see the abomination of desolation, then that is a real game changer. If you are in Judea, verse number 16, okay? Judea is the kind of what I would call, for the sake of simplicity, the southern part of the modern-day land of Israel. Judea is the region where Jerusalem was and where the temple is, right? So it's, right, it is literally Judea as opposed to Judea and Galilee. Let those that are in Judea, let those that are in the closest proximity to the temple, then run to the mountains. Run to the mountains. I mean, this is, right? Just that fast. If you see it, which raises, I mean, it really does, folks. If we just think about it, and we're Bible literalists, it just raises some, I mean, we could just probe this to the end of time. What if you're in Judea and you don't see it? Is anybody in Judea not going to see it? How will they see it? Will they be able to witness it personally? Will they be watching it happen? Will they be watching it on their cell phones? I mean, if you're a futurist, you could bring that into the equation. If you're not a futurist, Jesus is literally saying to them, when you lay eyes on this. Run to the mountains. And Judea is very mountainous. And when we talk about the wilderness of Judea where John the Baptist was, there are mountains. But I think the point is, right? I mean, just to back up the big picture is, when this happens, get as far away from the temple as fast as you can. Get as far away from the temple as fast as you can. How fast? How fast? Verse number 17, if you're on the housetop, don't come down to the house to take anything out of the house. And we know that houses tended to have flat roofs. People went there, right? To put it in 21st century vernacular, you're out on the deck, right? You're out on the deck, you're grilling some burgers, and you see the abomination of desolation happen. Don't even go back in the house. Don't even go back in the house. Just go. Just go. Don't go back for anything. It's just been just about 8 years now. In November of 2013, our daughter and son-in-law's house burned down Sunday afternoon. I remember talking to him about it. You know, he said that things, you know, it got lights flickered and that was weird. And he said, I got up and all the kids were, you know, in the kitchen and we were just all there. You know, my wife was getting dinner ready and he said, I thought that was very odd. And he said, I went out the back to look at the back and he said, the garage was on fire. All I could see was a wall of frame. He said, we just went out the other door. Just like that. Right? You don't stop to pick up stuff. You just go. You just go. How urgent is it? And if you are at work, verse 18, neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. Right? So how urgent is this? When you see the abomination of desolation, if you are on your patio, you start running from the patio. And if you are at the office, you start running from the office. Get as far as you can, as fast as you can. And that is, right, those are divine instructions. As far as you can, as fast as you can. Waste no time. So the urgency is almost, folks, right? It borders on the unbelievable. I'm not saying it is unbelievable. I'm just saying when we read this, the urgency with which Jesus speaks, as far as you can, as fast as you can. And the horror of it is almost unbelievable. Verses 19 and 20. Woe unto them that are with child and to them that give suck in those days. Woe to pregnant women and nursing women. And add this to your prayer list. Pray that it doesn't happen in the winter. And pray that it doesn't happen on the Sabbath day. And maybe you have a solid answer. I just have spent much of the week trying to find out why the Sabbath, unless it's that it's going to violate the amount of travel that you're allowed on the Sabbath day. And that's a problem because Jesus himself was pretty clear that there are events that we experience as humans that make violating the technicalities of the Sabbath day permissible, right? Didn't you ever read what David did when his men were hungry and they hadn't eaten in 3 days? What did they do? They were eating corn, grain on the Sabbath day. They were violating the Sabbath. So what is it about the Sabbath day? I don't know. One thing, again, folks, we don't want to mistake, and I'm not, you know, like I said, this has nothing to do with my view of the rapture. This is a distinctly Jewish event. The Sabbath day is virtually meaningless to people who are not Israelites. And in fact, in many periods of time in its history, Rome didn't even operate on a 7-day work week. I mean, the whole concept of the thing starting over on the eighth day was not any part of the Roman mindset. They didn't even operate like that. That's a distinctly Jewish facet of keeping time. So, now, right, so I pause here, right? And this is my question, right? This is just a question that I ask myself. And I ask it from my bias of being a dispensationalist, believing in a pre-tribulation rapture and a premillennial return of Christ. If what we are talking about is simply a human military event, why that kind of urgency imposed on people? And I'm not saying that armies cannot move fairly quickly with great devastating power, but these are not modern armies. These are armies on horseback. If this is purely human in its configuration, if that is all that Jesus is anticipating, whether it be a Roman army or any other army, why that sense of urgency? Why that sense of doom? But there it is. When the trigger happens, when the abomination of desolation takes place, then get as far away as you can, as fast as you can. And pray that it be as convenient for you as is humanly possible, that it be in the best of weather, under the best of circumstances, so that you can maximize your travel speed. Right? Because again, folks, what are the issues? The issues are that pregnant women and nursing women are going to slow things down. And we need speed. We need to get away as fast as we can. And that brings us to the third point, and that is the context for this instruction in light of the trigger. Right? We have a trigger. This is going to happen. When it happens, this is what you do. Why should I do that? Why should I literally run away from my home without even going back in it to collect my wallet? Why should I do that? Why should I, if I'm at work, never even bother to go back home but just start running where I am? Nothing but the clothes on my back. Verse number 21, for then, because then. Because then will be great tribulation such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, Lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, Behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth unto even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, the eagle, there will the eagles be gathered together. All right, so we have a triggering event, the abomination of desolation. We have instructions in light of that event, as far away, as fast as you can go there. And we have finally the context for this instruction. Why should I sacrifice everything for my own personal safety? For at that time, and again, I just want to point out to you in verse number 21 that the word then there is not indicating sequence as much as it is indicating kind of a similarity. At that time, for then, when that happens, at that time, there will be great tribulation. And some of the critics of the position I hold, the dispensational, pre-tribulational, rapture, premillennial kingdom, point out that there is no such thing as a technical, biblical event called the Great Tribulation. And I'm not going to fight with you over that. I don't know that that's the point Jesus is trying to make. We tend to divide the tribulation that way, but I wouldn't fight over that. I would just look at it and take it at face value. For then shall be great tribulation. And we would literally, I mean, if we just wanted to be dictionary perfect, right? Mega pressure. Mega pressure. This unbelievable vice being squeezed upon the world. Such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. Right? So the world has never seen anything like it yet. And it never will again. Nor ever shall be. Right? So I mean, again, if we're just, right, without trying to get dealing with the eschatology, without trying to deal even with the time frame, if the Lord said to us, right, when you see this, run for your life. Don't go back home. Don't go pick up the family. Don't go pack a bag. Just start running. Lord, why? Because the worst possible thing to ever happen to the world is getting ready to happen. Something that is unparalleled to this point in human history, and something that will remain unparalleled ever. The worst thing imaginable. And in fact, verse number 22, and except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. And the idea there, I think a good way of thinking, you may have a note, is limited. Right? The Lord is going to limit how long this lasts. Because if the Lord did not limit its duration, it would be the extermination of every living human being. Nobody would survive. Nobody would survive. It would be complete and utter destruction of humanity. And only the fact that the Lord has limited the time. If you recall, right, David got into trouble for taking a census, which was basically a way of calculating just how mighty and powerful he was. And so the Lord sent a prophet who gave him three alternatives, right? 3 years famine. Is it 3 years? I think 3 years famine, 3 months, 3 days. And David said, I'll fall into the Lord's hand 3 days because he's merciful. And he proved himself to be merciful because he killed so many people that he said, I don't think I'm going to go the full 3 days. I don't think we're going to go 3 days with this. So the Lord limits the time. So again, right? And again, I pose the question from my desire to defend my dispensational, pre-tribulational rapture, premillennial return of Christ. Was the assault of Antiochus Epiphanes in 167 BC the single worst event in human history? And how would you calculate the biggest event in world history. And folks, it just seems to me that contextually the only way to calculate, I mean, what do you mean by the worst day in human history? Right? How do I calculate that? Well, Jesus calculates it in this term. If God doesn't bring a stop to it, nobody will survive. So it's not the worst day in history with terms of the fall of the stock market. And it's not the worst day in history with terms of how many people are sick. And it's certainly not the worst day in history as we measure human happiness on some kind of measurable scale. It is simply this. How many people survive? How many people are going to survive this thing? Was 167 BC the worst day in human history by those terms? I don't think it was. Certainly not in terms of numerical death, certainly not worse than World War I or World War II, but let's forget about World War I and World War II because those are primarily Gentile endeavors. The usually reliable Jewish historian Josephus estimates that 1.1 million Jews died in the course of that battle. That's a lot of people. But it's only 1/6 of the Jews that died in World War II. Six times more Jews died in the Holocaust than died in that battle. What is the standard of measurement? So, right, this is one of the reasons that, not the only one, but one of the reasons that that the preterist position, viewing this as basically all history, poses a little bit of a challenge to me, because I could come up with a way to market the darkest day in Jewish history, the destruction of the temple, which isn't the first time that's happened, the massacre of Jews, it's not the first time that's happened. But since the benchmark that Jesus seems to be using is sheer human death, how is it possible to be the worst event in world history? But let's go back to the right. Let's just kind of go back to the outline. We have a triggering event, the abomination of desolation. We have a series of instructions, get as far away as fast as you can. And we have an explanation for that radical set of instructions, because then, right? The greatest tribulation in world history, verses 21 and 22. Right? I'm not telling you to run away from an inconvenience. I am telling you to run away from an absolute disaster of epic proportions. Run for your life, literally. But that is not the only reason, right, for these instructions. Verse number 23 and verse number 24, another factor, another component of the instruction, the context, is the presence of false Christs and false prophets with wonder-working power. Verse 23, then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, miracle power, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. All right, let's just pause there, and I'm not going to go terribly far down the election road, apart from making this point, right? There are some people, good people, who believe that the rapture will come at the very end of the tribulation, the Lord will return, will be caught up, will be brought right back down together with him. Some people believe that the rapture of the church will happen in the middle of the tribulation. But let's not miss this, folks, right? I don't hold those positions, but let's not miss this. The Lord has made it clear in these instructions, verses 21 through 24, that he is more than capable of preserving the lives of his people wherever they are. In the midst of the greatest disaster to befall humanity, God will limit the days for the sake of his elect. And in the presence of miracle-working demonic powers, God will keep his people from believing a lie. So wherever we fall on this, folks, and if I can put it this way, whatever the actual undeveloping of the truth is, if I am standing up here in all sincerity painting you one picture and I am completely off base, the Lord is able to take care of you. The Lord is able to preserve your life as long as he wants you to live, and the Lord is able to keep you spiritually safe as long as you're alive physically. Have no fear about that. I mean, Jesus says, right now, I would argue that this is entirely Jewish in its context. He is talking to Israelites, particularly to Israelites living in close proximity to the temple. Right? And you need to run. That's your responsibility. But I'm going to take care of you. That's my responsibility. And you need to listen to what I say. That's your responsibility. But I'm going to protect you from falling for deceitful speakers. That's my responsibility. And again, folks, in verses 23 and 24, the word then means at that time. Right? While these things are going on. And these miracle workers, these false prophets and false Christs will be so powerful. This is something that is not described of them in verses 1 through 14. Right? We live in a world filled with wannabe Jesuses. People who claim to speak on God's name and on God's authority. People who claim to be Messiah. But there's another layer coming to this. And that is that these people are going to be invested with mighty powers and great signs and wonders that are so believable. I mean, this is the point that is being made, folks, in verse number 24. So believable that they would deceive the very elect, except I'm not going to let it happen. I mean, so you can envision a scenario in which a guy like Apostle Paul is going, wow, this might be the Messiah. And the only thing that's keeping Paul from doubting is the Lord's assurance himself. Not Paul's intellect, not Paul's Bible knowledge. Because these guys are going to come with great powers. And verse number 25 then functions as an assurance, right? This is the kind of thing that God assures us of on a regular basis. I'm telling you this before it happens. Right? Don't be surprised when it happens. I'm telling you it's going to happen. Now, we are a long way down the road from this, folks, but eventually in the book of Hebrews, our attention is going to turn from the ministry of the high priest to the faith of God's people. And a very simple definition of the word faith is acting upon the instructions of another. Whether it is faith in men or faith in God, we act upon the instructions of another. That's what faith is. Right? So here is an exercise of faith. Look, I'm telling you this ahead of time. I'm telling you this ahead of time. And there is one final factor to play into the context, right? We have a context for this radical set of instructions based upon this single event. Right? The greatest tribulation the world has ever known is coming. Miracle-working false prophets are coming. And the Son of Man is coming. Verse number 26, wherefore, on the basis of 23 through 25, wherefore, if they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the desert. Right? Remember, who's saying? Who's going to say to you that he's in the desert? These deceitful miracle workers. Right? They're going to do their thing. They're going to persuade many. Where is the Lord? He's in the desert. We're going to the desert. That's where he is. Don't go. Or behold, he is in the secret chambers. He's not making himself known. Look at my many miracles. Look at the signs and wonders that I'm doing. But he doesn't want to be seen publicly. He's going to be over here in this basement. Nope, don't go there either. Do not believe it, verse 26. Why? Is it because he's not coming? No, no. It's because when he comes, it will be like a flash of lightning across the sky. It won't be in secret. It won't be unknown. It won't be out of the way where only a few can find it. No, when he comes, it'll be like this. As the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even unto the west, a flash of lightning across the sky, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. When you see the swarm, or actually, I looked this up. I didn't know this, right? Because you may have a note or you may have a translation that calls the eagles vultures. I mean, it could be any of those things in our language. So I asked Google, the fountain of almost all knowledge, what do you call a flock of vultures? And here's the word. They're called a kettle. K-E-T-T-L-E. But when you see the kettle of vultures circling in the sky, you know something. There's a carcass down below. It's not a secret. This is the point, folks. It's being made in opposition to verses 23 and 24. There are going to be lots of people saying, Jesus is coming. Jesus is here. Not everybody knows this. It's a great secret, but if you'll come with me, I'll show you where he is. No. When he comes, everybody will know. When he comes, it'll be up in the sky in letters writ large. Here comes the Son of Man. So, I have in my notes that we're almost to the place to go to Daniel chapter 9 if we have the time, and I'm looking at the clock and it's almost 10:45, so we don't have the time this morning. But so let me just make a couple of points in before we turn our attention away from this. All right, I want to just take a couple of minutes, and again, I've already made my apologies and my explanations. I am dispensational in my viewpoint. So I believe that Israel and the church are separate entities. I believe in a pre-tribulational rapture, that Jesus is going to sound the trumpet and take us out before the tribulation begins. But that I also believe, as a subnote under that the rapture itself is not the beginning of the tribulation, that the tribulation begins when the covenant is signed, wherever that is. I believe in a premillennial return of Christ, and that is that Christ is going to come to earth and then set up his kingdom, which is going to last for 1,000 years. Those would be my positions. But those are minority positions. Those are minority positions. And if you believe those, you are today in a minority position. By far the largest position is what is known as the preterist position. Preterist coming from a Latin word referring to history or past. The preterist position argues that these events were fulfilled with the destruction of the temple in AD 70. That's just what a preterist believes. You can go to the Ligonier website. R.C. Sproul was a tremendous man. He's with the Lord now. He was a great guy, a great friend of Christianity, a great teacher. He was a preterist. That the book of Revelation is a book written from a historical perspective. Okay, part of being a preterist is arguing that the book of Revelation was written prior to the destruction of the temple. Right? Because John is not writing Revelation as a historical book. He's writing it as a prophetical book. And therefore, John wrote it prior to AD 70 so that he could predict the destruction of the temple, and that's what it's all about. Within preterism itself, there are two main variations. One is what is known as partial preterism, which is what a man like R.C. Sproul would have been. And partial preterists believe that everything is in the past except the return of the Lord. Then the other major viewpoint within preterism is called full preterism, or as they prefer to call themselves, and I like the word, right? They call themselves consistent preterists. They believe that Jesus returned upon the destruction of the temple. That view is generally viewed as a heterodox or heretical position, because, folks, it just puts them clearly at odds with Acts 1:11. Right, the only way you can make Jesus to have returned with the destruction of the temple in AD 70 is to symbolize his return. He didn't come to earth physically. So they just argued that he came back in a spiritual sense. He came back in vindication upon the temple. But here's, right, so I would just point out, right, that to be a full preterist makes you basically a theological heretic. But if you're going to be a preterist, it is the only preterist position worth having. That would be my understanding. Because you have no basis. You have no real basis of going, well, it all happened in the past except Jesus didn't come back yet, but he's coming back in the future. But wait a minute, folks. Whether we understand it or not, our blueprint for the return of Christ is the Olivet Discourse. And Jesus went from the abomination of desolation to his return, public and visible, in virtually the same breath. One is going to lead to the other. How can you be any other kind of preterist besides consistent? I don't know how you could do that. So, again, some of the other reasons I wouldn't be a preterist, that's just me. I'm not trying to put words into their mouth. I'm telling you my interpretation of it. Okay? I'm not trying to put words into their mouth. Now, so next week, we will come and we will start. We'll come back to Matthew just long enough to orient us again. We'll go to Daniel chapter 9. If we have enough time next week, we're also going to go to Daniel chapter 8 because it talks about it as well, and we need to get our bearings there. So, right, but 13 minutes till 11 o'clock, and we'll be back then. Thank you.